Sharing stories of Maine veterans on Veterans Day 2016. Veterans Day originated 97 years ago as Armistice Day, marking the first anniversary of the end of World War I. In 1954, President Eisenhower changed the name from Armistice Day to Veterans Day. And since 1975, it has been celebrated on November 11th, no matter what day of the week. Veterans Day pays tribute to all veterans. It is a day set aside to reflect on their service and sacrifice and to thank them. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we are going to do just that. We are asking you to join us by sharing stories of veterans who are important to you and have made an impact on your life. We are joined by three people who have committed their lives to helping veterans and remembering their service. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today we honor the veterans in our lives, especially those who are still with us. Our special Veterans Day show is about the stories behind the men and women who have given of themselves to serve our country. Do you have stories to share about yourself or a veteran you know, about struggles and courage, funny anecdotes, memories? Here's your chance. With me in our studio, Adria Horn. She is director of the Maine Bureau of Veteran Services. Lee Humiston is curator of the Maine Military Museum. And Peter Ogden is on the board of directors for the Maine Military Historical Society. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As always, we want you to join our conversation. What stories do you want to share? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We did this program last year. It was really wonderful, and I'm so glad, Lee and Peter, you can come back. And Adria, congratulations on your job filling Peter's big shoes. at the Bureau of Veteran Services. Well, I just want to start by asking all three of you who dedicate your lives to serving veterans what this day in particular means to you. Peter, for you, is this a day like any other day of the year, or is this elevated?
Well, it's elevated in a way, but it's also the same as every day because we look at veterans every day. I mean, in my previous life as a director of veteran services, we took care of veterans every day. And since I retired, I still deal with veterans. I still do a lot of things. So while it's really important because we honor those that have fallen, you know, remembering those days and those that are alive today, we also part of that is also just remembering all veterans. And, you know, I like to thank Maine. Is every day in Maine is Veterans Day in Maine because really Maine cares about veterans. We've always cared about veterans. And, you know.
All right. What about for you, Adria? What does today mean?
Today is an interesting day for me. I'm still serving in the military and I'm on a lot of social media sites. And what I love about today is seeing former soldiers, friends actually all posting about themselves and their stories and their service that they don't otherwise do every other day of the year. I love watching that. I love watching one day when they actually tell their story in a way that you're not going to get any other day of the year.
Yeah, I was going to say, when we put this program together, I get the sense that family and friends are going to call in because most of the veterans I know are pretty humble and don't talk about themselves easily.
That's right. That's right.
Lee, what about for you?
Every day is Veterans Day for me in the museum. We're open 365 days a year except for the Mondays, which I give to my family. But the veterans come, their families come, they see the artifacts they've donated to the museum, and it's a lifetime dream come true for me to have the place, to see it grow. In fact, since I was here last year, we've grown by a third.
A third.
And the new section is entirely dedicated to veterans from Vietnam. And they don't get enough coverage the way they should. And we have a lot of fun with it. And I have four men that work with me. Nobody works for me. And they're all combat veterans from Vietnam. And their stories are wonderful. And I love telling their stories.
Your museum is in South Portland.
Yes.
Give us quick directions.
It's at 50 Perry Terrace. It was what was once the VFW in South Portland. And a gentleman bought the building for me. It's ours. And we're at 50 Perry Terrace, South Portland, near Cash Corner.
Okay, Peter Ogden, tell me about the museum associated with the Maine Military Historical Society.
All right, Maine Armed Forces Museum is located at Camp Keys. It's by the Augusta Airport. So if you know where the Augusta Airport is, it's right by there. It's right beside the helicopter on the pedestal. So we have a big sign there that says an Army helicopter, a Huey, on the pedestal right there. So that's where our museum's located, right, Camp Keys.
Okay, and Adria, I know probably many of our listeners know about the Bureau of Veteran Services, but just in case they don't, give us a synopsis. What can someone find there? What kind of services do you provide?
Lots of different services. We have a couple different lines. I'd like to say that we do operate the 4 state veteran cemeteries. There's one in Springville, 2 in Augusta, and 1 in Caribou. And if you've not been, since we don't need national cemeteries that are burying veterans, if you haven't been, you should go. They are a wonderful tribute, and the staff there are outstanding, and they care about every single person that comes in. Additionally, we have 7 field offices for any veteran or family member to walk in across the state from Springville up to Caribou to file a claim with the VA to talk about education benefits, widows' pensions, dependency claims, anything that you could possibly talk about, even recognition. We have a lot of recognition programs honoring a veteran from a grateful state. And we like to engage people when we talk to them and find out when they served so we can actually properly give them the recognition they deserve from the state of Maine. Then we have a lot of advocacy services. If you know, you never really know where to go. I'd like to say that when you become a veteran, no matter how long you served, you all have the exact same 90-degree learning curve. There is no education to become a veteran and navigate all the services. So you got to start somewhere. You got to know where to call. We like to just have people call so we can start the conversation. And we always are educating people on what benefits they are really entitled to.
And you said you're still active duty military. How are you? Tell me what you're doing in the military and then tell me how you're balancing both of these jobs.
So I'm not active duty. I was active duty for 11 years in the Army, but I am still in the reserves. I've been in the reserve for 5 years.
Okay. So that makes a little more sense how you're able to balance your time, because I know being director of the Bureau of Veteran Services is a big job. Peter Ogden, I'll let you start. Tell me who you're thinking about today and a story you'd like to share.
Well, actually, I'm thinking about some units. You know, as the chairman of the Maine Military Historical Society, you know, we're beginning to think about World War I. 100th anniversary becomes next year. And the 103rd Infantry Regiment from Maine was mobilized and sent to World War I. So right now, this is about the same time that the 2nd Maine came back from the Laredo, Texas, 100 years ago. They were down on the border during the Mexican War. So they just got back in November of 1916, and that got remobilized in February of 1917. So to me, it's about the units and thinking about them, but also it's like individual veterans. I mean, we see a lot of veterans, and as I look through the museum and I look at things, and you start looking at the names and doing the history. But to me, I still think about Henry Poisson. Henry was a World War II veteran. lives in Turner, Maine. Henry's still around. Such a great guy, you know, served in World War II in Korea, was a member of the 150th Engineer Unit, and they built 300 bridges for General Patton during World War II. You know, and I had a joke with Henry talking about the number of bridges. He said they built 20 bridges over the same river because the river is so crooked, you know, in Germany. But, you know, people like him, and also from Vietnam, Gordon Kelly from down in Columbia Falls, and Gordon was a Vietnam veteran, was in Vietnam the same time I was, and Gordon earned the Distinguished Service Cross for his actions during the Battle of Firebase Burt, which actually the movie Platoon, the last battle in the movie Platoon, is based on that battle.
Hmm.
You know, so that, you know, and it's interesting as you meet Mainers, you think about these guys, you think about, because we have some from each war still around with us, you know what I mean? And I think it's important to remember those.
All right, Lee, what about you? Who are you thinking about today?
Well, several. Actually, my great-great-grandfather was killed at Gettysburg. He became the unknown soldier at Gettysburg, even though there were thousands of him. An 11-year-old girl found his body, and in his hand was the picture of his 3 children, including my great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. He has become an icon at Gettysburg, and he is the only enlisted man who has his own monument. There's lots for the generals and the colonels, but he has his own on the spot where he died.
Where was your great-grandfather from?
Originally from New York.
Okay.
My family have been here since the 1630s, so I'm a Mainer true and true. But on my father's side, they came in from Connecticut, went up into New York. But the person I think of most today is my father. And it's just a quick story, but my father was 37 years old, four children, working in the shipyards in South Portland, making more money than he ever dreamed possible in his entire life. But he couldn't stand seeing the kids go off to war. My father was 6'3". He's a big man. And in my day, as a child, my father was God. He ruled the house, bar none. So he went down to join the Navy. And he loved telling the story. The chief would look at him and say, "Mr. Humiston, we would be honored to have you in the United States Navy. But you need your wife's written consent."
Really?
Yeah. When my dad got up off the floor and he went home, and Ma said, "If it's important, go." And my dad spent 3 years in the South Pacific. And I think of him a lot because he loved the VFW. He loved the American Legion. He loved this country. And he loved his time in the service. In fact, he never forgave me for going in the Air Force. So,
were you alive when he signed up?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember that?
I more than remember it. My people ask me how I got involved in all this. I was 4 years old, and I remember my dad was getting ready to ship out, and I was in his arms and tried to pick the ribbons off his chest. So I've had a love for the military ever since. And again, not to steal more time, but my other favorite memory of my father was Christmas 1945. And because of his age and points, he got to come home. But those are days you didn't lock your doors or anything else. Well, it's Christmas morning. And I got up before anybody to see what Santa had left. And dear Lord, he was there. He hadn't gone.
Wow.
There he was in a chair. His duffel bag, I thought, was his toy bag. He had a big, full, bushy beard. And he had a Jap helmet on his head. And I lit up the whole house because that's not the Santa I was looking for. And that's how my father came home from the war to me.
So, wow.
Yeah.
He had a sense of a dramatic flair, didn't he?
Yeah. Oh, my father did that. Yes, he did.
Adria, tell me, is there anyone you're thinking about today in particular?
There are, actually. There's two people, three, I'll say. Vietnam veterans have a very, very special place in my heart. I have no family that was in the military. It was kind of a cold call for me to actually join. And wow. I have found in life the best neighbors you could possibly have are Vietnam veterans. They have, having not gotten the welcome home, they have it instilled in them, in every fiber of their being, that they're going to look out and make it better for somebody else. And they certainly made it better for my generation, but they make it better for you no matter what. So when I first moved to Maine, Dean Farwell and Marlene were my neighbors in Hollis, and I was still at Fort Bragg, and like a freak tornado came through the Hollis area and ripped a section of our house off that we had bought probably 3 weeks earlier and then weren't going to live in it for a while because we're still
goodness.
At Fort Bragg. So Dean called me while I was at Fort Bragg, and he said, "Oh, Adria, got a problem. It's a big hole in your roof." Thank you, Dean. And he said, "Don't worry about it, though. I put up three stories of staging and I patched it for you so you can actually call the insurance company." I am like still speechless to this day. Who puts up three stories of staging and patches your roof and doesn't know you? Dean Farwell did. And then there's Joe Hyde, who's my neighbor now, who is a Vietnam veteran. And my husband, we have a farm. My husband was killing himself putting hay up in the hayloft because we don't have a hay conveyor. And we'd been talking about it for a while. And literally, he was just exhausted. And up comes the road, Joe Hyde, with a hay conveyor. Like the sky parted and the hay conveyor came. And that's just, it's part of them. It is just part of them. They are going to make something better. On the individual level, they will try whatever they can. And they're quiet and they're humble and they will just make it better. And that's the same for David Patch, who is a Vietnam veteran as well, retired Navy Lieutenant Commander, and just an ardent advocate. If you looked at his signature block, it's every volunteering thing you could possibly do for veterans. And the man doesn't sleep. He does not sleep. He will find every single veteran out there and do whatever he can for them. And I just really appreciate him.
Well, these are wonderful stories. We hope that you'll share yours. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'd love to hear the story of your loved one, especially someone who maybe hasn't made the news headlines, somebody like the people that our three guests are talking about here today, who quietly do good work and continue their service not only to their country, but to their neighbors, and serve their country by serving their neighbors and family members. Peter Ogden, it's different now than it used to be, isn't it? When there were wars before the whole nation mobilized, and now so few people are actually active duty,
that it's easy to even forget that we're at war and that we do still have people deployed in dangerous places.
Yes, it is. I mean, you think about World War One. World War II, 16 million men and women served in uniform. Maine had over 112,000 men and women in uniform during World War II. Korea, we had 41,000 in uniform during that time frame. In Vietnam, 64,000 Mainers served in Vietnam over that period of time. Today, we're down into several thousand serving because just simply the size of the military is much different. The way the wars are fought is much different, and people are being sent back multiple times versus just once, and there's no draft. So we did that. On average, there's less than 1% of the nation that serves in the military today. And so, that's still interesting. Maine still has while they have a smaller population, we still have a huge veterans population because a lot of Mainers still—
One in 10, right?
Family history, that guy. It was interesting. I was just listening while I was waiting to come on the show. There's somebody talking about nationwide. There's about 62% of the nation has related to a veteran, and that's amazing to me to think about that.
Right.
Even though we talk about the smaller numbers today in the military, that still related to the those veterans. That's important, I think.
62%. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would make sense. And in this room, we're 4 for 4. Adria. Is it? I remember conversations with Peter in the past when he had your post talking about one of the challenges is finding veterans when they come back to Maine from their service. We're not a state with a Fort Bragg where people come back to this big fort with all sorts of built-in services. Does that remain a challenge for you to find, especially these young people who have served in Iraq or Afghanistan and have come home to Maine but were based in bases in other states?
Absolutely. This will be a problem for a long time. And I just want to say, when you're in the military, everything is there and done for you. And you are part of the, in the Army, the big Army family. You're part of that. And it's very easy for people to find out what unit you're in, what squad you're in. You can drill down. But once you leave, you don't re-enroll in something that has a mandatory way to track you. So to turn around and then have an expectation that we have something like that to track people and be able to find them in the same way that they were in the military is really just an unrealistic expectation. But we want that information because we want to talk to people and we want to get them aligned with services that they are eligible for before it gets to a point when they are in dire straits and need them more than they ever have.
Is it difficult because these are people who are used to doing things for other people?
Absolutely.
These are people who provide service.
Absolutely.
I'm not somebody who receives service. Is it hard to tap those people on the shoulder or grab them by the elbow and get them into your office?
Yes. In fact, I'll even say it's hard when, and I do this quite frequently, and it makes people very uncomfortable, and I appreciate how I'm making people uncomfortable, is that we have a lot of advocates because it's really a lot easier to advocate for someone else than it is for yourself. It is human nature to be able to advocate for someone more than it is for yourself. So when I talk to a lot of those who are in the advocates, I say, okay, let's just stop and talk about you. How are you? Where are you? And that's very uncomfortable for them. But a discussion that has to happen because some of those ardent advocates are really not doing what they need to be doing for themselves as well.
Interesting. We do have to take a break. When we come back, your stories. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Maine Association of Nonprofits, uniting and strengthening the nonprofit sector through management training and advocacy. NonprofitMaine.org and Apple Acres Farm. Fresh fruit, pies, gifts, and lunch in Cornish, Maine. AppleAcresFarm.com.
Next time on Living on Earth, we look beyond the elections to this new era of American politics and what it could mean for the challenges of climate change, growing cities, and public lands. I'm Steve Kerwood, and the changing politics of environmental protection is next time on Living on Earth from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us for Living on Earth coming up Sunday morning at 7 o'clock. Every day you hear messages about local businesses and organizations that provide their financial support to Maine Public. They all understand the value of Maine Public in our community and have decided to make Maine Public Radio and television a part of their marketing effort. If you would like to learn what these folks already know, visit mainepublic.org and click on About and then Business Support. There you'll find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information. Or you can just give us a call. We're at 800-884-1717. And as always, thank you for your support of public broadcasting in Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, learning about the lives of our Maine veterans. With me in our studio, Lee Humiston, creator of the Maine Military Museum in South Portland, Peter Ogden, who is on the board of the Maine Military Historical Society, and Adria Horn, director of the Maine Bureau of Veterans Services. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is David Ehrenstam. He is the author of Homecoming, A Soldier's Story of Loyalty, Courage, and Redemption. Hi, David. Thanks for calling in, and tell us a little bit about your book.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. My book actually came about because of some newspaper stories that I wrote about a Vietnam veteran living in Old Orchard. And he was the man. There was a POW MIA event in 2012 that he organized or helped organize to honor anybody who had been a POW or had their name listed as a missing in action soldier or serviceman. And so I conducted or I did these interviews and did some of these newspaper stories. And one thing led to another. And this man, Russ Warriner, told me the story about a mission that he flew in Vietnam as a helicopter crew chief. And in essence, the story is relatively simple, but as a writer, I was sort of captivated by the idea, and it in essence turned into this historical novel. And the idea was simply that he was part of a Huey crew. He was the crew chief and door gunner. There was a co-pilot and a pilot in command, as well as an additional door gunner, and they took off to fly a mission to perhaps maybe rescue or help this group of rangers that were trapped on a hill near the city of Wei. And that when they took off, Russ was pulled from the crew by the CO of the base to do an inspection on a different helicopter. Well, long story short, the helicopter took off and really was shot down, and he never knew or saw what happened to the men on the helicopter for the better part of a week. So he's telling me all of this as I'm learning more and more about the POW event that he is organizing. And one of the things that he said to me was, well, we finally figured out who we're going to dedicate the event to, and we're dedicating it to a man. His name was or is Michael O'Connor. And I said, who's Mike O'Connor? And he said, well, Mike O'Connor was the co-pilot on that mission that I was supposed to go on. So that in essence, became the story. Then he said to me, I found out Mike had served as or was a prisoner in North Vietnam for a little bit more than 5 years, and that he survived the war and came home and had a family and children in California. And I actually got in touch with him, Russ was telling me. Mm. And then he said, I asked him, would you mind if I dedicated the event to you? And Mike said, yes. And then he said, about a week later, I called him back and said, if we could scrape some money together to get a ticket for you to come to Maine, would you speak about your time as a prisoner? And again, Mike said yes. So he's telling me all this, and I, you know, as a teacher, as a writer, I'm thinking, oh my God. And then I said to him, well, Russ, this really isn't about me, but do you mind if I come to the airport when he comes to Maine? I'd like to kind of witness this and document this, because this certainly is the end of the story. The last time you saw him was 44 years ago, and he took off on a mission that you were supposed to go on. And on that mission, three men died, and he was the only one that survived. And so I went to the Portland Jetport in September of 2012 with Russ and four other men from his unit and watched as they reunited after 44 years. And it was nothing short of amazing, because in large part because these men at this point were well into their 60s, a little bit heavier, a little bit grayer. And as they waited and waited and waited for their friend to come back, you know, they sort of changed dramatically, became quieter, much more solemn, And then when Mike eventually landed at the airport, it was almost like they were 19 or 20 again for a few minutes. You know, they were laughing, they were joking, they were crying. You know, it was nothing short of amazing.
Well, David, go ahead.
I don't mean to take all this time, but that ultimately became the core of my book, this book that I wrote.
Well, David, thanks so much for calling in, and good luck with your book. David Ehrenstam is the author, and the book is called Homecoming, A Soldier's Story of Loyalty, Courage, and Redemption. Thank you, David.
All right. Thank you so much.
Peter, you were nodding during his story. Do you know the people he's talking about?
Yeah, I was there as part of the 2012 ceremony. What I was thinking about was talking about Huey helicopters. Actually, they brought in a Huey helicopter that was flown in Vietnam for the ceremony, you know, there. It was the same helicopter that the Maine Army National Guard flew. And then it ended up going out to Indiana to be part of something out in Indiana. But actually, it was flown in Vietnam, but it was also flown by the Maine Army National Guard, the 112th Aviation, and before it got sent to Indiana to be part of the Forest Service. You know what I mean? So that was kind of interesting. But I remember those POWs and the ones we recognized. We recognized some of Maine's POWs down there. I presented some medals during the ceremony with the governor at that time. So it was kind of really, you know, great.
I'm going to read an email from Ilsa. She wrote, I think it's important to honor those veterans who, because of their firsthand experience with war, have dedicated themselves to preventing war and promoting peace. So I want to pay tribute to the Maine Veterans for Peace. Dud Hendrick of Deer Isle was a midshipman at the U.S. Naval Academy from 59 to 63 and served as a commissioned Air Force officer for 4 years, one in Vietnam detonating explosives. In 1998, he traveled for 3 weeks in Vietnam with members of the World Team Sports. TEAM stands for the Exceptional Athlete Matters. Exceptional meaning men and women without limbs or other disabilities suffered during the war in Vietnam. He served as president of Maine Veterans for Peace Chapter 001 and has been arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience to protest the war in Iraq. He continues to participate in peace walks in support of working for peace in Palestine, South Korea, and elsewhere. In recent years, Hendrick has continued his multifaceted peace activism as a member of Island Peace and Justice and has been vigiling on a weekly basis since before the invasion of Iraq. Hendrick has also worked to publicize the displacement of indigenous people by U.S. military bases. Quote, much of my current peace work is first voicing opposition to more than 800 U.S. foreign military bases in more than 130 countries, and second, standing with the victims of all that displacement and destruction, says Kendrick. That's an email from Ilsa. Going to move now to Massachusetts. And Anne, hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm so glad to hear your letter from that you just read. It's just what I wanted to say, that working for peace is the most important thing that we can all do. It's the first order of from on high to us all, to love each other, and so that we don't have to have veterans suffering in silence or madness. But just if we could all work together, soldiers for peace, in every way we can.
Thank you, Anne.
I think that I'd like to respond to that. I don't know a single veteran who wants war. And sometimes I think there's a misconception that veterans themselves and those in the military are kind of war hungry. And I'll share a quick story if I could. When I got back from Iraq in 2004, I had spent a couple of late nights with a battle buddy creating the list of things that I want to do before I die. And the one thing I want to do, and I know a lot of people are going to think this is ridiculous, I wanted to go to a Madonna concert. I had never been. So my best friend, I was stationed at Fort Lewis, my best friend in Maryland bought tickets to a Madonna concert. And I flew out we got back from Iraq in April 2004. And like 3 days later, I flew to Washington, D.C. for a Madonna concert and was in absolute, complete, utter shock. It was the first tour she had done in a while. It was Gay Pride Week. There were thousands of men in very tight white shirts and kilts that said, Kabbalists do it better. And I was like wearing corduroys and a loose shirt because I was so uncomfortable in real civilian clothing at that point because I had been wearing a uniform, dirty, smelly, yucky for a year. We went to dinner and one of her friends said to me, this must be really hard for you because this like Madonna's really anti-war. And I just said, you know, I just spent a year in Iraq so you could be here at this concert, actually. And I acknowledge more than anyone else how important it is that there are thousands of people here for Gay Pride Week who are here to see Madonna have an anti-war concert. That's why I'm here.
Anne, thank you for your call. And Adria, thank you for your willingness to share that on the air. We're going to move on to Ulna. Alna and Marilyn. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. My memory of the veterans is in the 70s, I was a teenager and went with my parents for my father's reunion of his 76th Division, 304th Infantry, which took, they were in the Battle of the Bulge. And I spent 10 days with all of these veterans as they traveled through the roads and the forests and looked at the pillboxes that they'd been fired up on, and listening to their memories and stopping in the forest where they had lost a big contingent of men, where they stopped the bus and said some words, and also was at several receptions that the towns in Luxembourg and Belgium threw for these men that had liberated their towns from the Nazis during World War II. And as a, you know, teenage girl to have something like that make an impact, I will never, ever forget those men and that 10 days I spent with them.
Thank you for that story, Marilyn.
I'd like to go back to Russ Warner, if I may. When Russ Warner contacted me at the museum, because he knows I'm the archivist for the POWs from the Vietnam War, and I know probably 99% of them on a first-name basis, and he had no idea how to get in touch with Mike. And I called Mike, and then Mike got in touch with Russ. And after they had the reunion, Mike came up to the museum to see it. And we get no funding from anybody. We survive. Basically, we sell these brass plaques that commemorate the military history of lots of people. Mike loved the museum, but more importantly, he loved the plaques. And he went back home to California. By the way, we were neighbors in California. It's one of the ways that I knew him. But he sent me a check. He bought 22 plaques at $60 a piece. Every one of those were kids he served with that were killed in the first 6 months before he was shot down and captured. But the one that he loved the most, there were four South Vietnamese soldiers on the chopper when he went in. And he said, I never knew their names. He said, and we were in a prison camp. And he said, about 2 days, when the guards came in, perfect English, said, South Vietnamese boys, you go home. And he said, oh, God. And he said, 20 minutes later, we heard the shots. They executed him. Oh. He said, please do not put killed in action on their plaque, Lee. He said, put it up there. He said, but please list them as died as POWs, not killed in action, because they weren't. They were executed. And so that's a little addition to Russ's story. It's a good book.
Oh, you've had a chance to read it already. Oh, terrific. Yeah. An email from Kate. My grandmother, Virginia Williams, was a WASP in World War II, flying B-52 bombers at a time when there weren't many women in the service. After military service, she continued to be an active member of her community. Service was integral to who she was. As I was growing up, she was my role model that a woman could do anything. Wow, how many women were flying B-52 bombers in World War II?
Outstanding. None. Outstanding.
That's a terrific story. Thank you so much. We'll go to Damariscotta and Charlie. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead.
Jennifer, it's Charlie Stewart. How are you?
Hi, Charlie.
I wanted to get into an issue that when we made the film Matter of Duty, the issue of post-traumatic stress in Vietnam veterans. If you remember when we showed that film here in Portland, I was introduced it with you and was astonished about the fact that our research showed that Vietnam veterans were committing suicide today, so many years after, and sometimes in increasing numbers. And I wanted your guest to comment on what this means in the future, 40, 50 years from now, from the fallout from Iraq and Afghanistan and continuing post-traumatic stress in veterans who fought in those two wars.
Well, I think part of it is part of the issue is we deal with older veterans, all older veterans, is when you're young, you come back from war, whatever, you have a family, and for a lot of those have families, get jobs, you got something to focus on. And you can focus on a career, and then when you retire, as you age, you think about your life, and we think of, as veterans, we age, and we think more about when we were young and when we were there. And I think a lot of times you have more time to think because you can't have anything to focus on. So I think that's part of the challenge. And we find a lot of the veterans we deal with. I serve on the VA Secretary's Advisory Committee on Readjustment of Veterans, which is the vet centers that deal with Vietnam veterans and now all veterans. And I think that's an important part. But as part of it, for a lot of us came back with big issues. But the ones that had issues came back, had families, and got jobs. Now they're beginning to have more and more problems as we age, and we've seen that a lot.
I'd like to say that I think we frequently use a term transitioning veterans for those who are like immediately leaving service, and your transition begins like the date you separate from service. And I think we need to get away from that mindset that a transition belongs to a date, because there are lots of people who just mentally or emotionally take 50 years to transition. And I would also like to say that that transition is normal. We do not talk enough about the normal requirement of transitioning. We've gone from the military. Your life is so prescripted that you have no choice. And then you turn around and the next day you have every choice that you have never been able to have before. Mm-hmm. And I think that transition takes time to acknowledge, and that acknowledging that the transition is normal is really important. But you don't have that military group of people who understand exactly what you're going through anymore. You are now separate from them. So you're doing it by yourself. And this is a very, you know, layman's version of explaining like caterpillar to a butterfly, right? A caterpillar has to go through a metamorphosis. You cannot just become a caterpillar and be a caterpillar and become a butterfly. You have to go through this requirement of nature in order to get to the other side. You have to. And I don't think we talk about that as a normal piece of leaving the military and doing something else. And I would just like to offer that up. When people think they're alone or that something weird is happening to them, no, something normal is happening to you.
Adria, thank you for that. Charlie, thanks for calling. It's nice to hear your voice. We do have to go to another break. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Highland Green, a 55-plus active adult community on a 635-acre campus with nature preserve. HighlandGreenLifestyle.com.
The election is over. The result, shocking to some, didn't exactly match the media narrative in the final days. But media were criticized throughout the long campaign for failing to take Trump seriously, for failing to fact-check, for insisting on some kind of balance of critical coverage. Did media get the 2016 election wrong? That's this week on Day 6.
Join us tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the world reacts to the election victory of Donald Trump. Foreign leaders express concern about alliances and trade deals, and a Chinese official is named the new head of Interpol.
Stay tuned for the Diane Rehm Show coming up today in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're sharing stories of our Maine veterans. With me in the studio, Peter Ogden with the Maine Military Historical Society, Adria Horn with the Maine Bureau of Veteran Services, and Lee Humiston with the Maine Military Museum. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. 877-399-3566. Before the break, we were talking about post-traumatic stress. Lee, we didn't have a chance to come to you because we had to take a break. But what would you like to add to what was said before?
Well, it's basically about the museum and the place it holds in this state and in my mind and those who helped me build it. My museum is different than any museum you'll ever come to because it's about people. There's artifacts in every museum. There's thousands of them. But our museum is basically about people. And the men who work for me are all combat veterans. And I was just mentioning one who was on hunter-killer teams. He was a tunnel rat. He was a sniper. And his psychiatrist at Togas thought that it was the worst thing could happen to him to be in the museum. But it's one place he finds solace. And he was interviewed on television not long ago, and they asked him, what is it like for you to be here? He said, truthfully, he feels like I'm in the house of God. He said, because I see the faces, the uniforms, and I think of the things, not all the bad that happened. And he's a good friend. One of the other guys, and this is very quick, but he told me the story. He brought things to the museum, and I have these plaques, as I mentioned earlier. So he told me about his best friend who was killed, saving him in Vietnam. And he said, every night since 1967, without fail, I dream of him. And he's in the back of the vehicle. It was an Army personnel carrier. And he said, he won't come out. And every night in my dream, I ask him, come out. Please, please come out. And he won't come out. And so I put those plaques up on the wall. And when he come in, he just stared at them for about 20 minutes. And then he got up and he left. And he called me a week later. And he said, Lee, and he was crying. He said, they came out. That's what the museum means to people who come through it, because it's a live experience. It's not just about guns and weapons. I mean, dear God, there's enough of that. But it is about people and the stories that they tell and pass on and sit around. So it's become a home. Thank you.
Joining us on the line now, Joy Asuncion. She's a 20-year veteran of the Navy and on the board of Honor Flight. Joy, did I pronounce your last name correctly? Joy, are you there? Joy? Joy Asuncion, are you on the air? Oh, I'm so sorry. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
You did. Thank you.
Okay, great. Tell us about Honor Flight if people haven't heard about it.
Yeah, I would love to. I'm actually at an Honor Flight fundraiser today in Augusta at the Red Barn. They're donating all their proceeds to Honor Flight today, which is fantastic.
Excellent.
But I've been with the board for about a year and a half now and got interested in Honor Flight about 2 years ago when I became a guardian. And Honor Flight Maine is a nonprofit organization. We have a board of directors, a chairperson. We're all volunteers. And our primary mission right now is to take all of our World War II veterans from Maine and any terminally ill veterans to Washington, D.C. to see their national memorials built in their honor for their service and sacrifice. So the fundraiser that we're doing today is just one of many that we have throughout the year where we try to raise enough money to, you know, be able to have our World War II veterans have that opportunity to see their memorials because it's no cost to them. We do have guardians that go with each of the veterans, whether it's a family member, friend, or neighbor, or somebody from Honor Flight that goes with them to make sure that they stay safe. So we go down for 2 days. Basically, we leave on a Friday. We come back on Sunday, usually around noontime, into the Portland Jetport. And we recently had a trip 2 weeks ago where we took 45 World War II veterans with us. Four of them were women, and the oldest one was 99. And it really is life-changing for them. You know, a lot of times they haven't really talked about the war or their experience in the military, and this gives them really an opportunity to, you know, meet other World War II veterans, have that camaraderie, and see their national memorials. And many of them will tell us that, you know, they're there standing in for their comrades that didn't make it home. Nice. And it's just really quite an experience, and I'm really just honored to have the privilege to be part of it.
Joy, do you have a veteran you're thinking about today, a story to tell?
I do. My dad was a John Lewis. He was a World War II veteran. He served in the Army from 43 to 46 during the China-Burma-India campaign. He never talked about his service at all, and he did pass away many years ago. But that was the other thing that really attracted me to Honor Flight, was because I was so really desperately wanting to understand about my father's service more. And through Honor Flight, I've been able to learn more from World War II veterans that actually served in the same time frame that he did. So that's been really, special to me and very important and something I really cherish. I always take his photo with me to the World War II Memorial. I've been on 4 Honor Flight trips now since I've been on the board. And I take his picture with me, and I make sure that he knows that, you know, I'm there representing him. And, he's a very special man.
Well, Joy, thanks so much for calling in. Joy Asuncion is a Navy veteran on the board of Honor Flight.
And an outstanding advocate in the state of Maine. Thank you, Joy.
Thank you, Adria. We're going to go to Paula, who's calling from Millbridge. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just calling to honor my father, who is 94 years old, who came through Ellis Island with his mother and his sister and fought in World War II. In Africa, and he was an immigrant, and he became a United States citizen. I guess that transitioned the fact that he was in the war. He became a United States citizen. So,
and where was he an immigrant from?
Czechoslovakia.
Fantastic. Yeah. How old was he when he came to the U.S., and how old was he when he served?
He was 9. He was 5 when he came through, and I guess he was 18 or 19 when he went into World War II.
Wow.
And as I said, he went to Africa. And my dad never talks about the war. He's a very quiet person and never, you know, mentions it. So I really think it really, it was very sad. But, he's made it, and I just want to thank him and all, immigrants that did the same as my dad and came to this country and fought for this country.
Paula, thank you for your call, and all 3 of our guests are nodding and agreeing with you today. We're going to move to Yarmouth and Amy. Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Hi. My father was a Vietnam veteran. This is the first Veterans Day that my dad and I haven't been able to spend together. He passed away in February. And so this morning, I spent my morning at the Southern Maine Veterans Cemetery with him, just talking. As I left, I drove down to where most of the graves are, and just to look around. And you know, it's very humbling to see all these servicemen and women their families. And I'm honored that my dad as my dad. But I'm so proud of all of our servicemen and women and our veterans. And I just wanted to mention that and to say happy Veterans Day and thank you so much for your service.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, what a wonderful way to end our program today. Thank you so much for your call, Amy. And that is going to be our last call today. And thank you so much for all 3 of you for coming down, both Lee and Peter, for the 2nd year in a row. And we hope to make this a tradition. Thank you, Adria Horn, Director of the Maine Bureau of Veteran Services, Lee Humiston, Curator of the Maine Military Museum, Peter Ogden, on the Board of Directors for the Maine Military Historical Society. We will make sure and put links to all 3 organizations on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page after the program today. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 7, on Fridays at 7, the rest of the week at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.